Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'll be talking to George Eaton and Anoush Shakalian about the fallout from the Autumn Statement, Zan Rice talks to Daniel Trilling about migration into Fortress Europe, and John Elledge, Philip Maughan and Rhiannon Lucy Coslett talk about private schools and privilege. It's the week of the Autumn Statement. Traditionally quite a small affair, but it's taken on huge significance in recent years. It's also considered this year to be the big final fiscal statement of the coalition. I'm joined by George Eaton and Anoush Shakalian to discuss it. George, you were watching the statement, you lucky person you. Let's start off by saying, how did Osborne look? What was he, you know, what kind of, he didn't bring a kind of austerity chancellor vibe to it. He brought a kind of good times are here again feel, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And anyone watching it could have guessed, you know, there's an election only five months away. And even by Osborne's standards, and of course, as well as Chancellor, he is the Conservatives' main political strategist. It was a statement sort of brimming with political intent. So it was aimed really at minimising the Conservatives' weaknesses, as they see it on the NHS and on wealth taxes. So he said, we'll be spending more on the NHS too. He's announced what is really his own version of the mansion tax with these new charges on higher new stamp duty charges on the most expensive properties. And then it was aimed at maximising their strengths, so saying only we can be trusted to finish the job of deficit reduction. And Labour's in this difficult position where it started the Parliament by saying that Osborne was cutting too far and too fast. Now it's attacking him for borrowing too much. But it also would cut at a slower rate in the next parliament and leave room to borrow for investment, all of which it makes perfect economic sense, but try explaining that to the average voter.
As I say, you can't put that on a leaflet, can you? Anoush, I'm also interested in what was the response both from Labour and Tory backbenchers? You know, how this came across to other people in parliament?
Well, I think there was definitely a sense of seeing George Osborne moving on to Labour territory in a way. It's something that George wrote yesterday. So there was this idea of him trying to have sort of the Tory version of the mansion tax and also talking about giving money to the NHS. But I think what Labour MPs were saying was actually it wasn't as comprehensive as what Labour wants to do, because there's no new money being spent. So he wants to scrape this £2 billion a year together from sort of efficiency savings from other Whitehall departments. So it's not really a positive idea for the health service. So I think that Labour MPs were feeling quite, you know, quite optimistic, actually, because they see that the Tories cannot be trusted with the NHS. So.
And I'm also interested to know, kind of, let's take the bigger picture, George, and look back at Osborne over the course of this whole parliament. So he wanted to clear the deficit completely. He wanted to keep the UK's AAA credit rating, which we lost for a year. Has he, I mean, you mentioned in your column this idea that he sort of turned into a hyper-Keynesian now. By his own standards that he set out at the beginning of the parliament, how has he fared?
Very badly. So he originally promised, yes, to have balanced the books, that is to say, to have eliminated the structural deficit by 2014-15. He's now not hoping to do that until 2017-18. As you say, he lost the AAA credit rating, which he made such play of before the election. And of course, he's failed on growth and wages as well. That everyone forgets. He didn't somehow say yes, we're going to have 3 years of stagnation and then the economy will bounce back. He was predicting that we'd have healthy growth from 2010 onwards. And of course, he inherited an economy that was growing fairly fast from Labour, and a lot of economists agreed, did huge damage with the VAT rise, cuts to infrastructure spending, and the rhetoric around debt crisis, which had a sort of chilling effect on confidence. What happened in the middle of the parliament is that I think he partly recognised the damage that some of his measures were doing, slowed down rather than accelerating the cuts to try and sort of chase his targets. And that is partly to explain, accounts of the bounce back. But of course, Osborne won't say that. So he still plays the austerity chancellor, even though, albeit as a result of economic failure rather than of political choice, he's been far more profligate than expected in 2010.
And Anoush, here's what interests me is that, you know, we've heard that then privately, George Osborne is quite relaxed about immigration. You know, he sees the undoubted economic benefits of having young, economically active people coming to this country. But he's very much out of step with where the gravity of his party is taking him. Do you think in the next parliament, if the Tories get either, I know it's very unlikely, an overall majority or end up in another coalition, that his disjuncture from that kind of hard right, particularly the Eurosceptic wing of the party, is going to become a problem for him trying to get measures through that he wants?
I actually don't think it will be a problem for him, because if you think about it, if the Tories get in again, he's going to be their champion, because it's thought that if they win, then they're winning on the economy and he's the Chancellor. So I think he'll have a lot of weight, a lot of influence in the cabinet then. And perhaps also if the Tories deliver a win, then their backbenchers will be less cantankerous about these EU immigration issues.
I think
issues.
That's quite hopeful, isn't it, given how cantankerous that they've been this parliament. And George, you pick up that point you said about wages, because this is a really interesting point, is that, you know, we've heard from Labour so much about the cost of living crisis. Partly that was pegged to the idea that prices were rising faster than wages. Now that now looks like after a long period that's reversing. But equally, well, the tax receipts weren't as high as we thought. One of the reasons of that being that people are underemployed, they're in, you know, 0 hours contracts, they're in part-time work. Is there a hope there for Labour that they might be able to make those smaller economic messages work for them?
Yes, I think there is, because even though the economy in the last year or so has grown faster than people feared, and as you say, wages are finally starting to crawl above inflation, Labour can still say you are worse off at the end of the parliament than you were at the beginning. And I think that's the first time that's ever happened, actually. Ed Wall says he's sort of looked at the data. It's the first time it's ever happened in a whole parliament. And that gives them a strong attack line against the Conservatives. And the more the Conservatives say, well, look at all these, the record number of jobs we've created, the economy is bigger than it was in 2010, we're back above our pre-crisis peak, the more Labour can say, well, why aren't people feeling it then? I think that's an important point, that actually these data points don't really relate to people's own experience. And a lot of their consumption is still based on debt. So I think the Conservatives need to strike this very careful balancing act between persuading voters that the economy is better off than it was in 2010, without appearing to sort of give the impression that that they're complacent and they somehow think that everyone's feeling cheerful.
That's funny, isn't it? Because it's the corollary of what happens with immigration, where you say, although this is the macro picture, people who feel that their schools are under pressure, that jobs are being lost to Eastern European migrants, it's very hard to counter that big rational argument with what people feel in their lives. I think that line that comes out of Labour about voters don't live their lives in the macro, isn't that right?
Yeah.
The final thing I want to ask you, George, is just a little bit about budget cuts in the next parliament. Most people, it's now sort of seem to assume that austerity has really wreaked its terrible, you know, havoc, or it hasn't, depending on your position on that. But how bad will those budget cuts be in the next parliament?
They'll be very bad. So the OBR has worked out that 60% of the cuts are still to come. So a lot of the time Osborne will say, oh, the job's only half done. In fact, it's only 40% done. And of course, the easy cuts have already been made. The low-hanging fruit have been plucked. And so rather than cutting into some of the fat that even statists will concede was there in Whitehall, they're now going to have to cut into bone. And local government in particular is going to be crunched. Now, on paper, of course, all the numbers add up. But in practice, are these cuts really going to be feasible if you get to the point where services are seriously collapsing? So prisons are in chaos, courts aren't able to function, rubbish collections end. And of course, all of this is premised on the economy growing at the rates the OBR forecast, when we know the global economic situation is still pretty perilous. Interest rates are going to rise likely soon after the election. You're not going to have so the Bank of England printing money in the way it has been in this parliament. And so to try and pull off an even bigger fiscal tightening than we've seen in this parliament in a incredibly difficult economic climate domestically and internationally looks incredibly ambitious, especially if, as Osborne claims, he's going to do it with no tax rises, which is one reason why a lot of economists don't take his pledges seriously, and why Vince Cable, who of course still sits around the cabinet table with George Osborne as business secretary, is deriding him as lying, basically.
Well, on that extremely pessimistic note, I think we'll leave it. Maybe next week we'll talk about something, you know, taxes on reindeers or something a bit cheerier. I'll say thank you very much to George and Anoush.
I'm Zan Rice, features editor of The New Statesman, and I'm here with Daniel Trilling, the editor of The New Humanist magazine. And Daniel's got a piece for us in the magazine this week about migration, a subject that's very much in the news and on the political agenda. Daniel, can you just explain to us briefly what the story's about?
Yes, thanks. So my story tries to reconstruct the route taken by refugees who arrive in Europe after having taken dangerous boat journeys across the Mediterranean, and they arrive in Italy. And this is looking at just one of the routes these refugees take across Europe all the way to London, because this is, you know, it's been something very much in the news recently. And a lot of the coverage has focused on Calais, just on the other side of the channel, and the 2,000 plus people that are there at the moment trying to reach the UK without the correct documents. So really what I wanted to do was just to look at the lives of these people and say, well, who are these people, and why are they trying to take these journeys, which, you know, they're very difficult and very dangerous. And yeah, that was the sort of initial idea for it.
Okay. And how did you go about the reporting for this piece?
So the piece draws on research that I've been doing for the best part of a year. I first visited Calais in February, and then it was just to really see what was going on and make contact with different migrants and see if I could keep in touch with them and follow their journeys. The piece for The New Statesman began when you, Zan, asked me if I knew anything about this story that had appeared in the Daily Telegraph in September, where a family coming back from a trip to Europe had discovered a Sudanese young man hiding underneath their camper van when they arrived back in Kent. And I think originally you asked me, well, do you think you could find out what happened to this young man and how he's moved through the UK asylum system? And I said, well, that's going to be difficult because everything is going to be kept very confidential for at least a few months, if not longer. But I'm pretty sure I know where this young man will have been, and I can retrace the steps of a typical route that someone like him would have taken, and draw on my interviews with other refugees who've been along that route.
Okay. And in some of these interviews which you've got in the piece, the lives and the aspirations and the hopes of some of these people who are trying to come to Europe, not just the UK, other countries in Europe as well, is laid out very nicely. Often when there's a news story about migration, particularly across the Mediterranean, it's one of tragedy, it's one of people dying at sea, and it's presented very much in those terms. But the people that you spoke to, they don't seem to want to be pitied, they almost approaching it from a very, very optimistic standpoint, rather than you know, we are coming here and we need help. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, I mean, one thing I wanted to do with the piece was to not only show the hardships that people face as they try to find ways to get around Europe's border policies, but their resourcefulness, because, you know, these are people that have travelled thousands of miles. They've had all sorts of obstacles placed in their way. They've risked death several times along the journey, and yet they've managed to make trips and make crossings that I certainly wouldn't know where to begin with it. So, for example, there's one young man in the story who managed, you know, he arrived in Venice after having hidden on a passenger ship from Greece, and managed to make it all the way from Venice to Calais with just, you know, after having arrived with just €2 in his pocket. So, I mean, you know, to just unpick how and why people have done that, I find fascinating. For this piece, I focused on people who had come from Eritrea and Sudan. And for the most part, I think they would probably meet the legal definition of refugee in that they're fleeing persecution by their governments. And they certainly have had some very difficult and very traumatic experiences along their journeys. But it's also true that one of the reasons they travel is that they don't just want a safe place, but they want to get on with their lives, and they want to, you know, they want the same things that any of the rest of us do. They want to sort of achieve things, and they don't just want food and shelter, but they want perhaps a career, or they want to feel like they're playing a useful role in society, or whatever you might call it. So, you know, there was one very striking encounter I had with a woman from East Africa, who was living rough in Calais at the time I met her, trying to get into Britain. And, you know, she had a story where she was fleeing persecution by her government, who were targeting her ethnic group. But the reason she wanted to come to Britain and not, say, France was because she spoke English, and she just wanted to get on and do her PhD. And she said, well, I'm 40 years old. I don't have the time to relearn, to learn French. I already speak English, and I just want to get on with it. And I think it's only when you start looking at the detail of people's lives that all of these things become apparent.
Can you tell us, if you've got a migrant arriving across the Mediterranean in Italy, what is one of the most common routes they would use if they were to come to the UK? And in addition to that, can you just explain the last leg of that journey from Calais to the UK, which is quite extraordinary.
Sure. I think, if I can remember correctly, about 160,000 refugees have landed in Italy this year. By no means all of them travel towards the UK. Many will stay in Italy. Many will try and go to Germany or Sweden or other parts of Northern Europe. And it's probably good to think of, I mean, one of the things that I feel this piece tries to uncover is that there's this kind of hidden network of routes throughout Europe that the refugees know about, but the rest of us don't necessarily. And one of them heads towards Britain. I think a typical route would be if a refugee was rescued from the Mediterranean and landed in Sicily or the south of mainland Italy, they would try and make their way up the Italian mainland. If they have money to pay for a taxi or for public transport, they would do that. If not, they would, you know, maybe try and do it in stages or earn money along the way. They would reach a large city in the north of Italy like Milan, try and make contact with other migrants, usually from their, you know, usually from their own home country, because for obvious reasons, you know, they'll share a language and be able to ask people who've done the journey previously, well, how did you do it? They'll get some advice about that. Then from Milan, they would go to the south of France, often by train, then try and get another train up to Paris, and then from Paris to Calais. You know, how quickly and easily people can do that route depends on what money they have available to them. So they might be borrowing money. They might have relatives who are wiring their money from elsewhere in the world. Or they might just be trying to ride the train without a ticket and hope that they don't get caught. The last stage of that journey is the most difficult, because they have to travel from, if they want to reach the UK, they've got to cross the Channel. And I think that's one of the reasons why this has become such a big news story in Britain, is because there have been these very striking scenes of hundreds of destitute migrants living in Calais or trying to storm the ferry port to get onto the boats and lorries or having fights with one another for access to the lorries. And it gives the impression that somehow this, you know, the UK is unusual and that everybody is targeting Britain. Really, these journeys are happening all throughout Europe. And the only difference is that they've hit a kind of difficult border that is actually very hard to cross. So most of them aren't successful. And that's why they end up living in Calais for weeks or months at a time. But what they would do to get into the UK if they can is to try and hide underneath a lorry that then goes through the Channel Tunnel or goes onto a ferry and cross.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Buses to Dover. It's very difficult. Access to the lorry park. So what migrants will do is at night time in Calais, they'll go out to one of the lorry parks outside the town where drivers park up and have a rest or sleep or check their documents before they cross the channel. And they'll try and sneak onto the lorries. It's dangerous for a number of reasons. The lorry parks are controlled by gangs of, sort of organised criminal gangs who will charge migrants for access to the lorries. They'll often also intimidate them and steal their money. If you want to actually get into the back of a container lorry, you usually have to pay a people smuggler to do so. A lot of the migrants don't have the money to do that, so what they'll try and do instead is to just crawl underneath the body of a lorry and hide between the wheel axles and the underside of the main body.
Thanks, Daniel. Just one last question. The Italian Navy has rescued about 8,000 people, I think, this year from the Mediterranean. The UK is of the view that this is actually encouraging migration and it's not a policy that they support or that the government supports. What is your view on this?
Well, I think, the UK government has said that it won't support, it won't give any financial or practical support to Mediterranean rescues because it considers this to be a pull factor, as in, in ordinary terms, that means that it will encourage more people to try and make the crossing. I think this is a very cynical position taken by the government because they don't want to be seen to be doing anything that would encourage migration to Britain because the Tories were elected on this pledge to cap immigration. And I think first and foremost, I think, Britain is part of Europe and all European states have got a moral obligation to save people. If there are people crossing and they're at risk of dying, then we should be doing whatever we could to prevent that, first and foremost. Secondly, I think it's a particular problem Britain has with its relation to Europe, that it has this illusion that it can, that it's kind of something separate from it and it's not part of these processes, or that, the government's excuse for why it doesn't want to take part in these rescues is that it said, we should focus on, improving the conditions in the countries these migrants come from so they don't feel like they have to leave. And again, this gives the impression that we don't really have much to do with what's going on in these countries. Well, I mean, one of the major reasons for the increased flow of migrants across the Mediterranean is the collapse of Libya. It means there are not only are migrants able to cross through Libya and take boats fairly freely because there's no functioning sort of state there, but also ethnic minorities in Libya are fleeing in their thousands because they're being subject to sort of unprecedented racist violence. And, Britain is intimately connected with what's happening in Libya, like the rest of Europe. We've, for years we've been, we struck deals with Gaddafi for cheap oil and cheap gas. There's even, there's literally a gas pipeline running from the coast of Libya to Sicily along exactly the route that these migrant boats are taking. And then Britain was part of the NATO action that helped depose Gaddafi. So, I'm not saying this was right or wrong, but we're already connected to what's going on there. And, refugees are a consequence of some of the actions we're taking in the world today, and we should be doing what we can to support them.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
I'm John Ellidge. I'm joined by our columnist Rhiannon Lucy Coslett and by Philip Maughan to talk about private schools. Rhiannon, you wrote a piece for this week's magazine talking about what you described as the confidence gap, the sense of self-belief and entitlement that the private school education seems to give people. Can you tell us a bit more?
There was a report from the Institute of Fiscal Studies which said that private school pupils go on to earn £4,500 more a year than pupils who went to private school, to public school, to state school, sorry, than pupils who went to state school. Which I think is interesting because it even accounts for whether or not both groups went to elite universities as well, which implies that there's kind of a divergence that happens a lot at a much younger age. And I suppose I speculate about what I've perceived to be a confidence gap between people who went to state school and people who went to private school, particularly within the establishment. And I think that is something that's kind of minimising the ambitions of kids who went to state school. Certainly something that I have personal experience of. And I wanted to explore that a bit more, how the kind of corridors of power can be seen to be kind of closed off to you, depending on what kind of background you've come from.
And to what extent do you think this is a product of a particular style of schooling? And to what extent do you think it's just this kind of an all-pervasive attitude in private schools that, you know, the kids can kind of go on to do what they want and the world is there for the taking and that they're training up to the future leaders and so on? How much do you think it's that kind of sense of expectation which is perhaps missing from some state schools as opposed to the actual sort of educational styles?
I do think expectation comes into it in a huge way, actually, because when I think back to kind of year 11 at my school, so when we were about 15, we all had to do this computerised careers test. And about five people in our year came out with the same result, which was fish farmer. And everybody was a bit kind of confused by this. Why are we being told that we should be being fish farmers? You know, I was told that I should be a travel agent. And I just, when I think about that, I don't imagine that they were telling anyone who was at Eton that they should be a fish farmer or that they should be a travel agent. And it's this kind of minimizing of ambition. It's like my friend expressed a desire to be a journalist. This was at the same school, same careers advisor. And they said, oh, why don't you be a primary school teacher?
Yeah.
It's this kind of small shifting of your ambition downwards. It's that lack of expectation. Yeah, that
that's the smart
have
job as well, primary school teacher.
Yeah,
if you
exactly.
show kind of potential, teachers where you're going. I think they told me I was going to be a teacher, actually.
Yeah.
With not showing that much potential, but being quite gobby. So maybe that kind of got me on that path.
I'm resisting the urge to ask how they came to fish farmer because that seems such a bizarre choice.
Fish farms in North Wales.
I think if you said that you enjoyed spending time outdoors, that was one of the results that you got. My friend also got lorry driver's assistant, which I found kind of, she wasn't even allowed to be a lorry driver. She had to be his assistant. So I
suppose one of the difficulties we run into in having this conversation is that there is an argument, I'm not necessarily subscribing to it, but there is an argument that this doesn't reflect badly on private schools. It's a failing of state schools that they are kind of putting this sort of limitation on what they are telling their kids they can achieve. I mean, Phil, where do you stand on that one?
I think that's probably true. I remember doing these ludicrous tests, I think they're called CAT tests, where they gave you predictions for the exams you would take, you know, your GCSEs and your A-levels. And I was told I would get Ds in my A-levels when I was about 15. What is the purpose of telling me this? I mean, I'm sure there was one and some educationalist will step in. But, you know, I didn't. And I really didn't appreciate the kind of the battering down. I think, you know, actually putting your head above the parapet is extremely risky in a state school. You know, I went to a comprehensive just outside Middlesbrough, where, you know, my primary aim was to get through the day without sort of having to talk about football was one thing. And also, you know, not succumbing to violence in the playground. There was quite a lot of punching going on. And I don't think I learnt very much. And actually, my attitude now is one of sort of great sadness towards my time in school. I don't feel angry about people who went to private schools. I feel envious of them because I listen to the music and all the stuff that they, you know, the music classes, the languages, that's a real big one. You know, I don't speak a foreign language. I love to. And they seem to have been taught this stuff properly. Not everybody. It's complicated. But there is that. And the question of confidence, you know, our personalities are quite complicated, and I'm kind of I think I'm quite a confident person where it doesn't matter, but an extremely shy person where it does. So I would never ask about, you know, salary, monies, job, things like this. You know, I'd never put myself forward for anything, because I think the real difference between maybe it is a wider class question rather than one specifically about schools, but it's always seemed to me that if you come from a kind of working class or a lower middle class background, really you have an immense awareness of all that you're not, everything that's on telly, everything that you can't do. That's how I was always taught to think. I think it was sort of just grin and bear it, you know, it's not for the likes of you kind of thing. And that might sound a bit extreme, and it maybe happens in a quiet sort of a way, but that's in the schools.
Yeah, I do think the thing about money is quite interesting, asking for a salary increase, for instance, in a similar way to kind of the gender pay gap can be partially attributed to women not being encouraged to kind of be assertive in the workplace and not feeling confident kind of asking for more money. I do think if you've been to a state school, if you've been to like a comprehensive, and you finally feel like you've sort of crawled your way up into this industry that you've wanted to work in, and it's taken, you know, all this effort, you sort of don't want to do anything to jeopardize it once you're there. I have a friend who works at a national newspaper, and she's a working class scouser, and she was just saying, I just feel so bloody lucky to be here that I don't push for anything. I don't want to rock the boat because that could jeopardize it all. And I do think that's something that certainly a lot of people I've spoken to from state schools definitely feel.
I think the question of class is an interesting one, though, because I think it is quite difficult to disentangle the nature of the schooling from other factors such as class. I mean, I am one of the 7%, I'm afraid. I did go to a private school.
Ooh. Yes,
I get that when I'm just walking down the street. It's class war, that's what it is. It's damn class war. But I'm not actually from a particularly posh background. I'm from reasonably middle class in the sort of literal sense rather than the telegraph sense. And when I am... When I went off to Cambridge, where for the first time in my life I met people who've been to really posh schools, I did feel kind of below them in some sense, which is an absolutely ridiculous thing to say. But you can't quite, even from a private school, I still kind of got that. And a lot of them went on to have, frankly, more successful careers than me early on because they had a confidence that I lacked. If it was just education, I don't know.
You're also talking centuries. If you're talking about the aristocracy, you're just talking of kind of built up centuries of built up senses of entitlement that have been passed down for generations. I don't know if you've been watching Life is Toff on BBC Two, but like the sense of history that this family has, it's a documentary about a family living in a stately home in I think Cornwall or Devon. The sense of pressure and the sense of history and the sense of prestige that this aristocratic family has is kind of, you know, I do think that's definitely a factor. Yeah,
it's the ability to walk into a building like the House of Parliament and not instantly feel uncomfortable.
Yes,
is a really big thing. How do we? This is a big conversation for three of us sat in a room doing a podcast. But how do we fix this?
An unplanned podcast. Yeah, the listeners may be able to gauge.
Yeah, we're going to come up with some real good solutions here, guys. But if it isn't just a matter of, you know, the actual mechanics of the education, if it is a kind of class attitudes thing, is there not a risk that we could abolish private schooling altogether and you'd still get the same people gathering in the same rooms and with that kind of class networking going on? Will getting rid of the private schools, if that was an option, would that actually change anything?
I don't know. I think it would. I think if you look at Finland, which has done it, the standard of their general standard of their education has gone up. I also think it's really beneficial for you to go to school and indeed spend your life with a great variety of people from different backgrounds and from different experiences. It makes you a better rounded human being. It makes you a better politician if we're talking about the government. And I think, yes, class will always be a factor, but why not have more mixing? Why not have more mixing between the classes? I think while you've got this segregation that begins at such a young age, it's not gonna change anything. It's not gonna get any better.
Do you think we can improve things by providing more kind of support within state schools? I mean, sort of actually sort of sending people into state schools to say, no, you can do this, you should apply to Oxford or whatever it may be.
I think it's hard. I think that would be, I mean, when you look at kind of the Oxbridge system and how kind of if you go to particular private schools, you'll have someone coaching you for that interview. especially. And, you know, state schools don't have that. They're surprised if one person gets in from the sixth form. And I think, yes, that would be beneficial. I'm interested by the old direct grant system as well. I mean, that seems to have you know, at the time, really improved social mobility.
Loads of stuff we've done has improved social mobility that has fallen away. The educational maintenance allowance being one of the more obvious ones.
Of course.
Like 2/3 of my, you know, year in sixth form took that. I don't know how this will have affected numbers there now, but I imagine that it will have done, because so many people talked about that. Even in just in terms of like street cred, you know, there are serious issues about people bringing money into the house and not working and so on. But, you know, people stop saying, like, oh, I only come for the EMA. I mean, even if that's not really true, people would say that, you know, and you think, like, yeah, are those kids now not going to come?
Did you get any support with your university application out of interest?
I didn't, no. I was told by my head of year that I would never go to university because he thought I was too lazy and interested in other things.
Remind us which university you went to?
I went to Oxford.
So I'm kind of interested to know, like, did you just think, no, screw you, I'm going to do this?
Yes, a certain degree. I did. I was also very lucky in that. I think, as far as I'm aware, two people from my school have been... So sixth form's a bit better, but from my school have been to Uxbridge, and the one who went the year before me, and kind of I saw the path that she, you know, took, and so I kind of just copied her, basically.
Oh, I thought you were being brave, and it turns out you're just
following a woman.
Plagiarism, that's what it is.
No, there's not... guidance, really. There might be. There's careers advisors who kind of can do this kind of stuff in a little way. But when I heard about, you know, friends that I met there and what they'd been told, you know, which college to apply to, I did, you know, what they call an open application and just said, I don't know what the difference is, so just put me wherever. But they, you know, they say you've got a better odds if you do here, and also there's an anti, you know, and against our school kind of thing, so you should go to one of these places. They'd be less likely to expect your application. And I mean, it's a multi-million dollar industry. You know, there's a lot of thought goes into this.
Yeah. Rhiannon, do you think that there is a responsibility on universities to kind of to get more involved in this and have, you know, active outreach programs or even quotas?
Oh, totally. Absolutely. I mean, I went to UCL and I always wanted to go to UCL, and I still had the feeling while I was there that I was filling some kind of quota. I started off doing a law degree, which is obviously was very much dominated by people from a private school background. And I remember them all talking about what GCSEs and A-levels they'd got, what results they'd got, what subjects they'd studied. And my GCSEs were kind of, they weren't shit by any means, but they weren't great. They were a bit mediocre compared to the kind of 11 A stars that everybody else had who was there. And I remember thinking, oh God, I'm just filling this state school Welsh comprehensive, you know, up north quota for them. And I do think, like, so if you are going to have quotas, I think you have to be very careful.
Did you follow your friend in sort of thinking, I'm not going to talk about it, though, I don't want to rock the boat? Because that's very much the way... I didn't want to be the guy with the chip on his shoulder, so I almost just went silent on the subject.
I mean, in the end, I just switched course at the end of the year.
All right.
quietly and kind of not reluctantly at all. But I do think that sense... It was the first time, like you said, when you went to university and you were first confronted by the sheer class differences and inequalities in this country, it was kind of a real watershed moment. Mm. Because up until that point, I didn't even know these people existed, and I doubt they knew I existed.
It's amazing how knotted we get on this. I interviewed the novelist Jeff Dyer earlier in the year, and we talked about this and how the second you step out of the UK, this just disappears. When I'm abroad, I just don't even think about this for a second. And then I get back to passport control, and even in the queue, it's all back.
A Russian guy I met in a pub once asked me to explain the British class. And when you try and sort of put it into words, it's incredibly difficult, because you're saying, well, it's kind of, it's not really about money, it's about education a bit, it's about work. And
geography.
It's just, it kind of all this different stuff bundled together, but it's really not an easy thing to explain. And yet we all obsess about it in this country. It's a very British thing. On which cheerful note, I will say thank you to Rhiannon Lucy Cosslett and to Philip Morn. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast. Our theme tune is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons, and our producer is Philip Morn.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.